Hello and welcome. I'm Charles Keedon, editor of Alliance, the publication bringing you news, views and analysis of philanthropy worldwide. In today's podcast, we're discussing what it means to conduct philanthropy at scale. Not content to simply fund projects, activities or organizations, some of today's philanthropists have much bolder ambitions. They want to shift the systems which cause social problems to exist in the first place. Systems change philanthropy, as it is known, is linked to a more strategic or catalytic approach associated with building partnerships across sectors and leveraging resources with the aim of creating maximum social impact. But what does this all actually mean in practice? Is there even any agreement about what systems need to be changed in the first place? And who should be in charge of doing all this changing? Well, if you want to find out, then you need to get hold of a copy of the March 2019 issue of Alliance, which looks in depth at philanthropy's deepening relationship with systems change. But for a foretaste, I'm delighted to be joined by two philanthropy practitioners who are better placed than most to shed light on these questions. In the studio, we have Donzelisa Barroso. Hello, Donzi.
Hello, Charles.
Hello. Well, Donzi is Director of Global Philanthropy at Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors. She leads the firm's European advisory work and has contributed to Rockefeller's research series, Scaling Solutions Towards Shifting Systems, which is designed to improve knowledge and practice in this area. I'm also delighted to be joined by Rakesh Rajani. Hi, Rakesh.
Hi, Charles.
Rakesh is the Vice President of Programs at CoImpact, a philanthropic collaborative set up by Olivia Leyland, the founding director of the Gates Buffett Giving Pledge. CoImpact has just announced its first round of systems-changing grants of more than $80 million, which it claims will improve education, health and opportunity for 9 million people across Africa, Asia and Latin America. It's a pleasure to have you both with us. And Rakesh, if I can start with you, can you tell us a bit more about those grants, those $18 million, who they're going to and how you decided where to put your resources?
I'd be glad to. So these are five grants. We are supporting some of the sharpest thinkers and most committed people who have gotten hold of a proven idea and now want to make it go to scale. And they're working closely with governments, bringing innovation, ideas and the kind of infrastructure you need to make those ideas fly. I'll give you some examples. One of them is what is called the graduation approach. All over the world, you have households of people who live in ultra poverty, often women-headed households, for whom the services that are available simply don't work. And our grants take an idea that has been shown by research to be a really effective way to move poor people out of poverty. And what we do is now help take that idea, be incorporated into government social protection systems so that you go from helping 100 people or 1,000 people to helping hundreds of thousands and ultimately millions of people. So that's one example.
So which governments will be working on that particular program?
In this case, there's a program in the state of Bihar in India that now it's a state, but it has over 100 million people. They have an excellent government agency called Jivika that has a network that involves more than 8 million women-headed households who are part of the network. So we are piggybacking this proven approach on top of an existing powerful network that the government is implementing. This idea has been implemented by many NGOs around the world. This is one of the first times in which a government is taking an innovation and an idea that civil society has worked on and seeing how can it take it to scale so many more millions are reached and the idea is sustained over time.
So there might be some clues there about your operating approach. I mean, the language of CoImpact is around deep collaboration. You're pointing to collaboration with government, with civil society. Can you say a little bit more about maybe your approach, your theory of change that you're developing here?
I'd be glad to. So, you know, the problem we have is you have lots of systems that are broken on one hand. On the other hand, you have lots of ideas that are terrific ideas that have even been proven, but the two don't connect. And those ideas either fail to get traction or sometimes they stay in little boutique projects and don't go to scale. What we do is connect the two communities, the people with the ideas and the governments often and the agencies that can work at scale, and we connect those two things together. In order to do that, you need to collaborate. You know, you need ideas, different ideas, you know, and you have different sorts of actors who need to come together. You need private sector, you need civil society, you need government, and you need the people who can make patient, long-term funding of those ideas. It's easy to do a short-term system, to do a short-term project, but if you want systems change, you need the patience. You need at least 5 years, and you need capital that is large enough in order to be able to work out the deep changes you need over time to train people to think differently, for example, to be able to sustain those changes. Mm. So collaboration, you know, we do not have the best ideas. We don't have the answers of how to make this happen. But what we believe we have is we do know how we do know the people who have those ideas, and we have the ability to bring them together and give them the capital to deploy in order to get this to work at system scale.
And you've mentioned one example, and I think there are four or five other grants made in your initial round. So how much is going to that one? And maybe you could just highlight another example as well.
Right. So GVK is part of three grants for the graduation. They are getting $6 million. There'll be another $6 million to a program in Latin America and $4 million to a group at the World Bank that will be in support of those two programs as well as programs in 6 to 8 other countries, which are yet to be determined. So in total, we expect 8 to 10 countries to benefit from this approach, adding up to at least 1 million of the poorest households lifted out of poverty. Another program is called Teaching at the Right Level. This is a support grant to JPAL, which is an MIT poverty action lab, as well as Pratham, one of the world's best education NGOs. They're coming together with their partners in Africa, government and civil society partners, to help children learn. As you may know, as many listeners may know, lots of kids are now in school, but they are not learning. There are millions of children who complete schooling without the ability to read and count. This initiative is taking a proven model that has been tested in India and see if it can be rolled out in Africa in partnership, in collaboration between the Indian organizations, between the researchers and African institutions and African leaders. Another program that we're supporting is called Project ECHO, which is really exciting. The problem they are solving is if all over the world, including the richer countries, you have medical expertise concentrated in capital cities like London, Boston, New York, and people who have the needs in rural areas, and there's a disconnection between the two. If you're a poor woman in a rural village and you need healthcare, you will have to spend all your savings to travel to the capital city, and even then you may not get the help you need. How do you bridge that divide? Project ECHO has an innovative, proven model using technology and bringing communities together to bridge that gap in a way that is really motivating for everybody and solves real problems, essentially bringing the expertise to where the people are rather than moving the people to where the expertise is. And what we're now doing is taking this model and helping them scale it up in India and provide the seeds of a global model. Their big ambition is to reach 1 billion people, and the idea is that we are helping them set them on the pathway towards that goal.
Well, we mentioned ambition in the opening comments, and you can see from the examples you've given, three of the examples, the ambitions you have around the world. So at that this moment, it'd be helpful to maybe turn for perspective from Donzi Barroso. So Donzi, listening to Rakesh, listening to the kind of scale of ambition, I mean, what do you think? Do you think this is a new threshold for philanthropy? Do you think there's things happening in philanthropy that make it more able to catalyze these relationships than perhaps others?
I think so. And your comments about bringing the systems together, you know, the ideas with the mechanisms to make change happen, I think are really critical. I've been trying to learn a little more about the formalities of systems change. And one of the articles I was reading by Donella Meadows, who is an early thinker, she said, you know, if we don't try to change things, in essence, some of what we're doing is just moving deck chairs around on the Titanic. You know, we're not really solving anything in a larger sense. So I do think that given the wide scale acceptance, even among, you know, corporate foundations and for-profit companies of the SDGs as a framework and understanding the urgency of the problems that we're trying to address, I think, yes, philanthropy is ready for it. I think what donors need some support with is really understanding how to implement systems change. I think part of it also is managing expectations and donors' understanding of what impact is. Mm. At RPA, we really see it as an antidote to the very short-term sort of KPI perspective that many donors have taken over the last 20 years and realize that they haven't really gotten the long-term results that they wanted.
So let's talk a little bit more about Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors' experience. Your firm has published two reports on systems change. What are the key insights that came out? So there's something there about an antidote to a more KPI-driven, narrower approach. What else came out of the research?
Well, yes, as you said, there are two publications. And the first was really an effort to talk to social entrepreneurs who had great solutions and ideas for transforming things. But donors really needed to understand how to be better actors and how to support entrepreneurs. And so there were five main learnings from that, everything from really understanding collaborations at a donor level, empowering your grantees, being more flexible about how you request information from them in terms of shared reports and proposals and sort of streamlining that process for them, and really seeing it as a partnership. And thinking longer term. The second report was looking at how and why donors move from thinking about this perspective to actually putting it into place and
well, action. How well are they doing it? Do you think they're fulfilling this potential that you see?
I think it takes some time. I think that, donors are a different... We work with donors of all sizes and shapes.
Well, who's doing it well at the moment, in your view?
I think, there's... there's a group of donors in Colombia that is working on addressing issues related to water in a particular geography of Colombia. They are doing pretty well. We also house at RPA a donor collaborative called Oceans 5 that's looking at sustainable fisheries and other particular aspects of donor collaboration. They have a very streamlined process and sort of architecture for how they do their philanthropy, and they've had some legislative successes, which is their goal. I was going to say, I think donors are at different points in their understanding of systems change. And so a lot of what we've been trying to do with these two publications is to have conversations with donors in different parts of the world and help them to understand different perspectives than they may be used to and engage them in conversation and then in leading conversations locally.
Well, and Rakesh, you want to come in?
I wanted to jump onto the really important points in the first report that Donzi mentioned. If you put yourself in the shoes of a leader of a civil society organization, and to think of the pressures on them, they end up becoming a manager of scattered projects. If they have to spend 30, 40, 50% of their time dealing with donors, doing reporting, trying to raise money, they get short-term money. What that does, in addition to making life really difficult, is it fragments strategic thinking, is that it stops you from thinking about the deep questions, doing the deep analysis, and knowing how you can change the underlying roots of the problems we face. And instead, you go around putting band-aids. And unfortunately, funders can be part of the problem by only offering short-term money, by kind of offering earmark money. You know, something else may be a priority for you, but because the donor is interested in this issue, you are forced to work on that issue. So a huge part of solving systems change, working at systems change, is changing the model of funding and getting what we need to do is, instead of civil society organizations needing to fit donors, donors need to turn around and fit the logic, the strategic logic of the organization.
So what you're saying is philanthropy can as often set back as advance changes that need to be made. So that's a useful moment maybe to talk about the practice of philanthropy and the way that the system of philanthropy may need to change. Right. So I wonder if either of you, maybe Donzi, if you've got any thoughts about philanthropy practice, what needs to change there. Rakesh mentioned a couple of examples, longer-term funding.
Yeah, I mean, those were, as you said, some of the findings from our report. I think in many places, donors are used to really operating with a lot of autonomy. I think the points that you made about not being, no one donor being able to address an issue on their own really leads toward collaboration. I think it's really about getting donors comfortable with collaborating and sharing more information. And I think it's doable. I think one of the findings from our second report is that really donors learn best from their peers. So hearing from other foundations that have done well with sharing information and creating a collaborative around a particular issue, light peer pressure is a way to really shed some light on a practice that may seem very difficult. The other important thing that you mentioned is that a successful collaboration and a successful long-term project really requires a certain skill set and leadership. So that is an area that foundations often need to develop. There needs to be some capacity building and some development in that area.
Leadership for the people.
Leadership for the collaboration itself.
Well, Rakesh.
I would emphasize two things that are somewhat obvious but really important, I think, and need to be said, is taking a posture of listening and learning. When you want to make any sort of deep or large change happen at scale, it's going to be hard. There's no blueprint that you easily follow. The political economy of things come in the way. All kinds of things don't go according to plan. So what you need is not an amazingly well laid out plan that you then blindly follow, but you need to have the intellectual curiosity and the practices in place that will ask you, you know, they'll give you the information you need around, are things working, and will reward you for making the changes that you need to make as you go alongside. You need the leadership in the implementing organizations, the governments and the civil society organization, but you also need supportive leaders in philanthropy who understand that's what it takes and make sure that their support is tailored in a way that allows for that learning and adaptation. And the starting point of that is listening. You know, one very simple indicator is when there's a conversation between a philanthropist and who they are supporting, who's doing the talking and who's doing the listening. And unfortunately, too many of us philanthropists are just not good listeners.
But is that a challenge that it's going to be hard for CoImpact to live up to simply because of the model or the structures you have? Because in order to listen, it implies a critique of a more top-down approach. Yet to be part of the CoImpact's group, you have to be a donor with a certain amount of money in the first place. So how do you balance the elite nature of CoImpact's structure, which by definition is bringing some of the wealthiest people together to contribute money, with the need to listen, to be humble, to involve different voices when they can't have a seat at the top table, the decision-making table? How do you square that circle?
That's a real question. And look, let's be honest, people who are billionaires are used to having people listen to them. So the good news is that the group that has come together behind CoImpact have this commitment. They know they don't have the answers. They have the curiosity to learn. They have the humility, or wish to have the humility, to kind of learn and listen, and we help each other. In the way we go about doing things, we are very clear. This is not about us. It's about the people we're supporting out there. When we sit down and have a grant discussion, we're not co-creating this. No, we are your cheerleaders. We are going to be challenging you at times. We're going to ask you hard questions. But ultimately, our role is to listen to you and to support you to succeed. And the you here are the people on the ground who are making this happen. We're building in feedback. We just did a survey on what the experience of the grantees has been. And we are supporting our program partners to listen to the clients that they are helping. So feedback is built into our structure. Will we always get it right? I don't think so, but we hope we'd aspire to this. And we want to be open to the critique when we go wrong so that we can make improvements along the way.
I was going to say one of the principles that we highlight in the second report is really about how assessment, you know, how you will assess this round of grants, and the feedback that you mentioned is really part of the learning, and so it shouldn't be, if things don't go as planned, it's an opportunity to improve. It shouldn't be seen as a negative.
Absolutely.
I guess in my readings about systems change, one of the main principles also is do no harm. So really taking learning and taking the time. I think that's probably also a challenge for some donors, is really taking a long time to talk to people and learn about this process before you start implementing.
Do you think it's a particular challenge when working across countries, or is it the same considerations that you can impose your own?
I think it depends on the topic, really. I think if you have a collaboration around a particular issue, like I mentioned, ocean conservation, that's working internationally and that's been successful. I think it would depend on the topic that you're handling, but the principles are the same.
I would agree with
that. You've worked around the world. You've worked in Tanzania, in the US, in India. What's your experience? Is there some challenges working across borders or of legitimacy, say?
Yeah. I see now where you're going. I mean, look, I think each context is different, and the politics and questions of legitimacy in each country are different. And one needs to listen and learn, and we have to be careful to check our assumptions when we go to a different context. That said, as Donzi was saying, the principles, listening, humility, respect, wanting to learn, being flexible, having trust, all those sorts of things are going to be crucial in whatever context you're in. And I wanted to, the point Donzi made earlier around learning and the spirit of that, let's be candid. A lot of the history of when we talk about monitoring and evaluation is based on mistrust. I'm giving you my money, and I don't want you to mess up with my money. So I want to make sure you are accountable. It comes from a really harsh and an unhappy basis. For us, learning, measurement, evaluation are really important, but not from a posture of reporting up to your donor, but more around what will help you succeed better in what you're doing. And when you think of learning and monitoring in that way, and the philanthropist supports you to do learning and monitoring as a means to improving for yourself the goal that you have, I think it changes the narrative and the whole relationship significantly.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Tonzi, if you want to comment on that? You're nodding.
No, I agree with that. I was thinking, things happen regardless of our best efforts. So change can happen without a donor's intervention in a system. And it, if you make a grant and then something else changes in the context in which the grantee is working, it will affect how they are able to perform, but I think it really, we have to be flexible as donors, and we have to understand the context in which we're functioning and some of the sort of wild card scenarios that can happen.
Well, one wild card scenario I do want to mention, yeah. I'm not sure how wild it is, but it's certainly in the zeitgeist at the moment, is a criticism of elites, of social, political, economic elites, including philanthropic elites, are hearing much more criticism about philanthropy as a form of plutocracy and a concern about that and the impact it has. I'm just wondering, in the context of systems change philanthropy, that there's one system that philanthropy is a product of, and that is the economic system whereby wealth is concentrated in the hands of a few and some of it will be redistributed to the many, which is what I guess co-impact and some of your research at Rockefeller mm-hmm. is all about. To what extent, though, do you think that raises questions about systems change as an endeavor, rather than simply seeing systems change as a unit in which you intervene in a particular topic, whether it's conservation of oceans or healthcare systems? We're talking about the political economy that allows such inequalities of wealth and therefore philanthropy to exist in the first place. Is that the systems change elephant in the room, the one that is about the system that makes it necessary to be doing the work in the way you're doing it? I just wonder if you've got any kind of closing comments on that bigger question, given, it's so present now in the wider discourse about elites. Rakesh,
take that question.
Sure. I welcome this critique. I think it's healthy. I think we should be asking those questions around who is setting the agenda and are the rules of the game fair that allow lots of people to become billionaires. I'm also concerned about growing inequality in the world. By the way, many of our funders are also concerned about that. So I think this is healthy. I think that doesn't mean that everything in philanthropy is bad. There are philanthropic practices that should be criticized, and good for them for being criticized. But there are also philanthropic money that has done lots of great work change in the world. If you look historically, in any country, of the great advances made in health, in education, in social justice, in giving women rights, LGBT rights, environment, if you look at all those things, often the ideas and the people who brought those ideas to bear were funded by philanthropists. So philanthropy has had a role, a positive role in social justice. And so to the critiques that kind of take a completely black and white picture, that kind of whitewash and brush off all philanthropy as evil, I think are not helpful and frankly just not based on evidence. Mm. At the same time, we should not have an unbridled celebration of philanthropy. Like with anything, like with government or like with corporations, we need to be able to take an analytical view and critique it. I think governments are very important. So to me, I don't say philanthropy does things better than government. Governments do great things in the world. And without governments, none of us would be able to go on. But other things governments don't do so well. And I find historically, again, is when people with ideas that are funded by philanthropy come together with government, for example, some of the best things come to play.
Mm-hmm. Well, it is very striking that a lot of your initial round of grants are in partnership with governments. You haven't mentioned your work in Liberia, but that's a good example maybe to come to it next time. Donzi, any kind of thoughts on you before we
go? No, I agree with you. We part of what we do also is manage complex initiatives, and we're partnering with government in many places as well. We have a really interesting initiative that's working with the government of Nigeria to create direct payment services to services that will reach several million people when the system is fully set up. So that's working directly with the new ministry to create all the systems that are needed to put that those payments in place. I think we're all partners in trying to create transformation. That's maybe how I would end by saying that we're really not just trying to change a particular aspect of a system, but really transform how people are living and how that system works in function of giving them a better life. So that's maybe.
Well, that's a hopeful and optimistic note to end on. And we'll be following how that progress is made over time. And I just want to thank you, Donslisa Barroso of Rockefeller Philanthropy Advisors, and Rakesh Rajani of CoImpact for joining us today. You can read more about their work online at coimpact.io and rockpa.org. And for more philanthropy talk, check out our podcasts at alliancemagazine.org. And of course, don't miss our special feature in the new issue of Alliance Magazine. It's guest edited by the Lankelly Chases Foundation's Julian Corner, who takes the debate on systems change in new, interesting, and some surprising directions. But in the meantime, thanks for listening and goodbye.